My name is Stephanie Bell. I'm with Ellinger & Associates, and I'm the president of the Jefferson City chapter of the Federalist Society. To the 150 of you who are with us today, welcome. Thank you for joining us. In the last 4 years, we've been fortunate enough to host the statewide Federalist Society conference in the beautiful state capitol. And I believe one of our attendees is there now, maybe. And of course, we hope to return there next year. So a little bit more first before we begin about the Federalist Society. Membership in the Federalist Society is open to all. You do not need to be a lawyer, a law student, or have anything to do with the legal profession. Indeed, we have many non-members joining us today. So if you are new to the Federalist Society, what you should know is the Federalist Society is committed to three main principles. First, that the state exists to preserve freedom. Second, that separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution. And third, that the duty of the judiciary is to say what the law is, not what it should be. We are lucky enough to have three lawyers chapters here in Missouri, one in Mid-Missouri, one in St. Louis, and one in Kansas City, and several thriving student chapters as well. So to learn more about the Federalist Society and to join, you can go to fedsoc.org. And today we do have some people to thank. So first, the National Federalist Society organization has a wonderful staff who helps make events like these possible. So thank you to Lisa Azell, Kate Fugate, and Alessandra Cruz, who we have leaned heavily on this year to continue to be able to provide you with quality programming and who have been instrumental in helping us with the event today. In addition, thanks to our chapter leaders, Mark Rimmer and Eddie Grime, who you will hear from later today, and thanks to our other chapter volunteers who have helped specifically with this event and with our virtual programming throughout this year. Also, thank you to our members. FedSoc looked very different this year than past years, and I know one of my favorite parts of this organization is discussing and debating the important issues of the day with you in person. And we appreciate you sticking with us in this unusual year, and we are confident we will be returning to our regularly scheduled in-person programming again soon. With that, we have a stellar lineup of topics, moderators, and speakers for you today. And I'm pleased to introduce you to Mark Bremer of the law firm of Shands Albert in St. Louis, who is the president of our St. Louis Lawyers Chapter. Mark?
Thank you very much, Stephanie. The title of the first panel is The Future of the Missouri Constitution, Constitutional Convention, Initiative Petition Reform, It is now my distinct honor to introduce our moderator for this panel, Judge Steve Clark of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Missouri. Judge Clark was sworn in on the federal bench in June of 2019. He is a graduate of St. Louis University School of Law and the University of Notre Dame. Before taking the bench, Judge Clark had extensive litigation experience. He was the founding and managing partner of Runnymede Law Group, formerly known as Clark and Sauer, a national litigation practice representing clients in trials and appeals of complex commercial and constitutional litigation. Before founding that firm, Judge Clark had been a partner at several major law firms in St. Louis. In addition to his extensive civil litigation experience and practice, he also tried over 200 cases to conclusion as a municipal prosecutor. During his career, his national practice included handling cases in over 20 federal district courts, 5 federal circuit courts of appeal, and the courts of 9 separate states. Judge Clark, I now turn it over to you to introduce our topic and our presenters.
Thank you, Mark, for that fine introduction, and thank you for having me here. Thank you to you, and thank you to Stephanie and to the Federalist Society. I appreciate you putting on this event, and it's we're going to discuss a very important issue here today, and we're going to discuss the future of the Missouri Constitution. Now, the question I would first pose, is this a solution in search of a problem, or is this a problem in search of a solution? And so we're going to hear about that today. We're going to hear about the number of initiative petitions that have been filed over the years and have been on the ballot over the years. Some of those have passed by overwhelming margins. Some of those have passed by very close margins. Some of those have failed by overwhelming margins. Some of those have passed by overwhelming margins. So, or failed rather by overwhelming margins. So you'll see that the Constitution has been amended and attempted to be amended a number of times in the last couple of decades alone. So that forms one of the issues. Another issue is that currently pending in the Missouri legislature are a number of bills to amend the constitutional amendment process. Some of them include making the creating a greater threshold than a simple majority, and Speaker Wineman will go into detail on some of those as well. And just by comparison, the Missouri Constitution versus the United States Constitution, this will help frame the issue and help you decide whether you think there is an issue and whether there's a need for a constitutional convention and whether there is a need to change the amendment process. But the United States Constitution, including all 27 amendments, contains 7,591 words. The Missouri Constitution, by contrast, is more than 10 times longer at nearly 82,000 words. So with that, some of the provisions of the Missouri Constitution that have been passed by the initiative and perhaps others read to some much more like legislation than they do like a constitutional provision. Those of you who are familiar with the United States Constitution and some of the, I will call fundamental provisions of the Missouri Constitution, those that were enacted to be analogs to provisions of the Missouri, of the United States Constitution, tend to be shorter provisions. They tend to leave many of the fleshing out of the details of how those provisions will be implemented to the legislature. And some have said that the issue with respect to the Missouri Constitution, or at least an issue with respect to the Missouri Constitution, is that it's taking away powers from the legislature, and query whether that's a good thing, because once they're in the Constitution, they can't be changed other than by another constitutional amendment. So with that, as our background, it's my pleasure to introduce to you our first speaker, who is James R. Layton. Jim Layton is a formerly Missouri Solicitor General. He's now with the firm of Tuath, Keeney, Cooper, Mohan, and Jagstad in the St. Louis area. He's the head of the appellate group of that firm. For 22 years, Mr. Layton served in the Attorney General's office, and for 19 of them, he was the state's principal civil appellate lawyer. He's handled all litigation, or he was responsible for handling all litigation arising under the Missouri Constitution and handled cases involving proposed constitutional amendments. Jim has argued nearly 100 times before the Missouri Supreme Court, 4 times before the U.S. Supreme Court, and more than 100 times in other state and federal appellate courts. So I think it's fair to say that Jim is a rather experienced appellate litigator at all levels of the appellate process. And with that, we're in good hands because he's very familiar with the issues at hand. He was also an adjunct professor at the of law at the University of Missouri, teaching not only appellate practice, but state constitutional law. He has a number of organizations he belongs to and is chair of. He is also a fellow of the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers. So with that, I turn it over to you, Jim Layton.
Thank you, Judge. And thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me. I sometimes feel like I'm the non-Federalist Society member who frequently gets the opportunity to speak to Federalist Society seminars, although I admit my favorite was speaking to a student chapter a few years ago about the Trinity Lutheran case that I argued in the U.S. Supreme Court, where I began by saying that I might be the only real Federalist in the room because I was standing up for the states and my opponent, a member of the Federalist Society, was standing up for federal power. I'd like to share my screen, and I will put a graphic version up of one of the things that Judge Clark mentioned. One of the things that's different between the U.S. Constitution and the Missouri Constitution is simply its length. It used to be, when I was in person, that I'd hand out the Secretary of State's booklets that have the Missouri Constitution and the U.S. Constitution and have everyone put their finger where the two divide. It is a pretty dramatic difference between the two, but I'll put it up on the screen in this way. If you look at 1820, when our first Constitution was drafted for the state of Missouri, that was only slightly longer, 1,000 words per, or so longer than the U.S. Constitution at that time. The U.S. Constitution has grown slightly since then. our Constitution. My numbers are a little different than Judge Clark's because there are various ways to count. But our Constitution is dramatically longer and has gotten much longer in the last few years. In fact, if you look just in the last 14, 15 years, the blue here is what existed in 2007. The other two colors are the things that have happened since then. And the gray is simply the medical marijuana amendment, which constitutes Article 14 of the Missouri Constitution today. So there is certainly a difference in the detail that we see there. We have what Oliver Wendell Holmes once referred to as the great ordinances, these general statements. We have a couple that don't exist in the US Constitution and yet embody concepts that we deal with in US constitutional law, such as the separation of powers, which is expressly stated in our Constitution in Article 2, and the right to vote. Elections shall be free and open, which it doesn't appear anywhere in the US Constitution, but it is in our Constitution and has played a role in regard to the question of voter ID. But then look at things by contrast like this. No bingo license shall be granted to an organization unless it's been in existence for 5 years, and here's how you decide whether it's been in existence for 5 years. Or here's a crime. There actually is a crime defined in the Missouri Constitution. It's in the stem cell provision. Or here in the medical marijuana provision, you have a limit on how many square feet can be in a manufacturing facility and how many flowering plants can be in that facility. There is nothing in the US Constitution anything like these kinds of provisions that we have in ours. So why does ours look so different? Well, one reason is that the US Constitution was drafted as a delegation of powers, limited powers from the states to the federal government. And so it talks about kind of affirmatively, the federal government can do this, not what it can't do, but what it can do. State constitutions aren't that way. The states have all power, except where it's limited by the federal government, by the federal constitution or federal statute. That's one of the reasons why there was a debate about whether Congress could pass Obamacare. There was no constitutional debate about whether Massachusetts could pass RomneyCare. The state legislature in Missouri can do anything that it wants, as long as it doesn't violate federal law, except as limited by the Missouri Constitution. And it has simply taken more words to craft the way in which we're going to let the legislature can't act than the founders used to tell Congress where it could act. So there's another reason, which is just the methods of change. And so you know that for the US Constitution, Congress can initiate an amendment that takes a two-thirds vote in Congress, then has to be ratified by the states. Or there can be a convention, which requires a call from three quarters of the state legislatures. Whether that can be a limited call so that convention can only do some things like adopt a balanced budget amendment is a question we don't know because there hasn't been a constitutional convention in the United States since the Constitution was adopted. By contrast, in Missouri, we also can have amendments proposed by the General Assembly, but it merely takes a majority vote. And they can come by initiative petition, by getting signatures. And then they're ratified not by three quarters of the states, but by 50% plus one vote. So if 1,000 people voted in the election and 501 of them voted, then that would be part of the Missouri Constitution, regardless of what low turnout there happened to be. We do have a provision for a convention. And every 20 years, we have a vote in Missouri on whether to have a constitutional convention. In 1942, the vote was yes. In 1962, 82, 2002, the vote was no. I always wonder, and I can't ask you because I don't see you in front of me, how many of you remember voting on that in 2002? When I first started teaching state constitutional law in Mizzou, I would ask students if their parents remembered voting on it. In 1982. Most people don't recall. In 1942, there was a concerted effort to get a constitutional convention done by good government groups like the League of Women Voters, but also by substantial portions of the Missouri business community. A convention in Missouri cannot be a limited call. It is a constitutional convention. And it's based on a convention that we got our constitution in 1945, our current constitution, as well as constitutions in 1875 and 1865. And a whole bunch of amendments that were proposed by the convention that convened after the 1922 vote, but didn't actually come up with a new constitution. So, why else do we look different? Well, if you pair the how easy it is to change the Missouri Constitution with the distrust of the Missouri General Assembly among the public, then you get this need that people feel to put things in the Constitution instead of putting them into a statute. And a few years ago, well, I guess in 2019, in thinking about this and recognizing that the General Assembly was looking at ways to address the amendment process in Missouri, I called a couple of people I know, Michael Wolf, who had been the dean of the law school at SLU and also a member of the Missouri Supreme Court, and David Rowland, who is an attorney in Mexico, Missouri. These are two who, like me, have spent a lot of time over the years looking at the Missouri Constitution. And my idea was to see if the three of us could come up with some proposal for a way in which we could try and improve and hopefully shorten the Missouri Constitution. And so we sat down in person and then a number of times by phone and hammered out a set of three proposals that that we wrote about in a Post-Dispatch op-ed in 2019. They have not been even proposed in the General Assembly, much less adopted by the people of Missouri. So the first proposal that we made was to make changing the Constitution harder, not proposing change, but make changing the Constitution harder. Our view was that the problem here does not arise because people find it too easy to get something on the ballot. Frankly, it is very difficult to get something on the ballot. And although there's a lot of legislation out there that would make it even harder, it is very hard to get something on the ballot. You have to have thousands of signatures in much of the state, not every place in the state. And I noticed that one of the proposals that's in the legislature is to require signatures in a certain number in every county. I suspect that that may not be a constitutional under the US Constitution, but that's a proposal. There are proposals to increase the numbers, but our concept, David and Mike and I, was to instead really focus on the putting something in the Constitution. Because our view was that it should take more of the support of the people of the state of Missouri to change its constitution, our founding document, than to simply enact legislation. And the proposal we made, and there are many others that could be made, the proposal we made was rather than require some kind of supermajority, to simply say it's got to pass twice, unless it's a real supermajority the first time. And so instead of having things that that come to a head in 1 year and everybody thinks this is great, we really got to act on this, our view was that things in the Constitution are things that should require more deliberation and have support over time, not just one time. And not just for initiative petitions, but for the legislature. That it shouldn't be enough that the legislature in 1 year says, this horrible thing has happened. We have to amend our Constitution. They could say that, but in our view, the people should have to 2 years later think, yeah, that's still a good idea, instead of, oh, come on, that may have been important then, but let's take a second look. Our second proposal was to reduce the incentive, people's perceived need to amend the Constitution rather than to simply have legislation. And I understand why people have an incentive to do that, because we have seen instances in which legislation is passed by initiative and the legislature immediately repeals, guts, changes, makes it something other than what was intended. And our view is that the legislature ought to, absent a supermajority, ought to, for a period of time, not be able to change the people's will. But you can have a supermajority to correct an error. And part of the problem with having these things in the Constitution is that if we, it turns out that that's not the the ideal number for a marijuana growing facility, you can't change that without going back to the ballot. And if we could reduce the incentive to put things in the Constitution, we could open the door to legislative change, but not as easy as it is today. And then our final proposal is one that arises in part because if you make it harder to amend the Constitution, you make it harder to make changes to correct problems in the Constitution, regardless of what you may think, right, left, liberal, conservative, whatever you may be. It's possible that in drafting a medical marijuana provision, for example, you just screw up something. And we thought there ought to be a way to fix that, but there also ought to be a way to systematically go through the Constitution and find things that shouldn't be there anymore. Maybe we could get out the provision declared unconstitutional that women can opt out of juries, for example. The time has come, in our view, to create a more modern Constitution, and it doesn't have to happen by having a convention. The proposal we made was to have a bipartisan constitutional review commission, one that could go step by step, article by article, section by section through the Constitution and propose new language, hopefully shorter language, hopefully clearer language that could be used in our Constitution. Our proposal was that that be handed to the legislature, which hopefully would put things on the ballot, but also that with some kind of supermajority in that commission, it would be able to put things on the ballot itself. One of the suggestions I made that did not make it into our op-ed, which suggests to you that Mr. Rowland and Mr. Wolf didn't necessarily agree, was that there be a provision in the Constitution that would allow this bipartisan commission to simply transform something like the medical marijuana provision into a statute. So it could put on the ballot a provision that says, okay, this is no longer part of the Constitution. It is now a statute and will remain without legislative change for a period of time, but let's pull these things that shouldn't have ever been in the Constitution and make them statutes. So those are kind of the proposals that we have. I will close by saying that I am not particularly optimistic about a convention being very productive. I used to tell my students at Mizzou starting back in the 90s that I thought that any constitutional convention would probably deadlock on abortion questions. I think that is still reasonable, reasonable assumption that that would happen. But I also think that in the kind of increasingly partisan world in which we live, that the convention, which would be bipartisan, not nonpartisan, the way we crafted it is bipartisan, that it probably would not be an effective method of just taking a hard look, a hard, hopefully somewhat unbiased look at the Constitution and trying to craft something that better serves us in the 21st century. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim. So one thing for our audience members, feel free to submit questions through the Zoom Q&A function at any time throughout today's program. We will have a Q&A session at the end, and we have a hard stop at 1:30, but before then, as I say, we'll have some time for Q&A. So please submit those, and I'll be checking into them as they come in, and we'll keep things moving forward there. So with that, I'm pleased to introduce our next speaker, and that is Lowell Pearson. Lowell Pearson is the office managing partner and serves on the executive board of Hush Blackwell. He's a graduate of Stanford Law School, and he has degrees from the University of Utah as well as the University of Missouri-Columbia. His practice is a mix of administrative law, election and campaign finance law, litigation and appellate work, and he's represented a number of committees and individuals in the initiative and referendum area, so he's familiar with this whole process of not only the amendment of the Constitution either and the statutory amendment process, but he's been involved in litigating those issues as well. And most recently was involved in representing the 2020 Medicaid expansion effort, and he was involved in the drafting strategy and litigation involving that. So with that, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Lowell Pearson. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Judge. Following Jim Layton talking about the Missouri Constitution is a bit of a challenge. Jim, good to see you. And what I'm going to try to do here is talk at two levels. I'm going to start big, and then I'm going to go down a little bit at a granular level and talk about how this really has been functioning for the last decade. So when I was preparing for this presentation, one of the questions I asked myself, well, is this a new problem or is this an old problem? And the data that Jim showed about the size of the Missouri Constitution, might suggest it's a newer problem. But I don't think that's right, because this whole issue of how to amend the Constitution is something that goes back to before the Constitution was written. In fact, something I didn't know, but I learned yesterday, in the original Virginia Constitution, which was written under the Articles of Confederation, Thomas Jefferson actually proposed an initiative petition an initiative process. I don't know if we would have had people standing in Walmart signing petitions, but so it really wasn't a new idea to think about an avenue of direct democracy. The first one was adopted in Massachusetts shortly after the Constitution was created. I also thought it would be interesting to think about how we amend the Missouri Constitution, which Jim described, with the thinking of the founding fathers when they wrote the United States Constitution. And as it turns out, they didn't really think it was that hard to amend the federal Constitution when they wrote it. If you look back at some of the writings of Hamilton, not in the Federalist Papers at the time, and then also at Federalist 43 and Federalist 85, there's discussion that they thought they had gotten that mix just right. So since we have this huge disparity in how easy it is to amend the two constitutions. But they, like I said, they didn't think it was going to be all that hard. Now, history has proven that the federal constitution is difficult to amend. There have been 27 amendments, I think I counted right, since it was adopted. And of course, many of those were immediately adopted as the Bill of Rights, which was sort of a grand compromise that those not appear in the text of the original constitution, but that they, the idea was that they would quickly be added. If you look at the time period other than the Bill of Rights and the post-Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, we really had very little amendatory activity with the United States Constitution. So while I was going on my little walk down history lane yesterday, I also saw that this is not a new issue for the courts. I had forgotten this, but we all remember McCulloch versus Maryland, right? The case that involved the Second Bank of the United States and the Maryland collector refused to collect the tax that was imposed. And Justice Marshall wrote the opinion for the court. But by the way, I didn't know this, but Jim, who's argued hundreds of cases, has probably never argued a case like McCulloch versus Maryland. There was 9 days of oral argument. And Daniel Webster was one of the lawyers. And the opinion was issued 3 days after the oral argument ended. Now, I've had a few cases with opinions issued a couple of hours after the oral argument. I was pretty skeptical that the argument really mattered, but they certainly did it differently in those days. That I was amused by that historical footnote. But in the opinion, Justice Marshall talked about how the federal constitution should not be read as, quote, what he called a legal code. In other words, a statutory document. And the issue there, of course, was whether the Congress had the power to create the Second Bank of the United States. And picking up on Jim's comments about what the federal constitution is really what was discussed in the case, which is it is a broad statement of what the federal power is. Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution has something 20 plus enumerated powers. and then the necessary and proper clause, which was the issue in the bank of the in the McCulloch versus Maryland case with the second bank. And the court, of course, in McCulloch versus Maryland, as I'm sure everyone remembers, I had to look it up because I didn't remember, ruled that the bank was permissible as a necessary and proper function to the enumerated powers. So last thing that I will talk about here in the historical section, and then we'll get to what goes on in Missouri as a practical matter, is that the initiative petition process was also thought about by the founding fathers. And while, or at least some sort of direct democracy, maybe it wouldn't be petitions, but in Federalist 49, Madison talked about how the ultimate power is that of the people, but he says that that power should recur to the same original authority, in other words, the people, quote, whenever it may be necessary to enlarge, diminish, or new model the powers of government. Now, of course, there's no mechanism in the United States Constitution to do that. So why he was discussing it in Federalist 49 is maybe something of a mystery. But it, this whole concept of how should the Constitution be amended, what's the appropriate level of difficulty, should there be a role for the people to do it, was all something that was being discussed 200 plus years ago. So our conversation today, I hope in the next hour, we will solve all of the unresolved questions from the last 220 years, but Hamilton and Madison didn't do it. So maybe we won't either, but we'll try. So with that broad picture, let me now talk about what's gone on in Missouri. And as the judge said, I've advised people who have put things on the ballot and succeeded. I've advised people who failed to get on the ballot through no fault of their lawyer. And I've represented people who have got things on the ballot and failed. So just a little bit of statistics, because I think everybody sits around and says, oh my gosh, we have way too many initiative petitions. I mean, there's too much of this. And we'll talk about the quality of the output in a minute, but let's just talk about volume. I think that there is a conventional wisdom that there's too much initiative petition activity and there's too much stuff that goes on the ballot to amend the Constitution. So, and I'm going to, in the statistics I'm going to give you, set aside statutory amendments. Those are in a different category. But if you go back to 2012, so several election cycles, we have had 14 measures put on the ballot by the legislature. And we have 8 that have succeeded by initiative petition. So I don't know that that's obviously too much activity. They range from the minimal to the maximal. We have, I'm sure we all remember the much beloved 2018 bingo measure, which was, it's always fun to make fun of bingo. It's funny, Jim and I didn't talk about this, but he did, and I had the same plan too. You stole my bingo joke, Jim. But we had the bingo measure, which was put on by the legislature in 2018. And, you know, we've had very big measures. Amendment 2 in 2016 that imposed campaign contribution limits for the first time since the 90s. Medicaid expansion that I worked on. All of the Clean Missouri and Cleaner Missouri that deal with redistricting, which is about as fundamental as it gets. So we have big measures and we have small measures. And there's really no discernible pattern to this that I was able to figure out either. As probably most people know, when measures are placed on the ballot, they by the Constitution, they are on the next general election ballot after the signatures are certified by the Secretary of State. But the governor maintains the ability to call a special election for any measure. And governors have exercised that power frequently. That was done by Governor Parson with the Medicaid expansion measure, which was on the August 2020 ballot, probably the most The famous example was in 2014, when then Governor Nixon put several measures, including a sales tax for transportation uses, on the August ballot. And certainly governors do that with an expectation of, you know, the turnout that's different in the different elections. I think the last thing I'll talk about is a little bit of the strategy and the constitutionalization, if that's a word, of measures that might not have been in the Constitution before. So there used to be a conventional wisdom in this initiative petition world that putting things in the Constitution was not the right strategy in many cases. And there was two parts of that conventional wisdom. One is it's just more expensive because you have to gather more signatures, about 30% more. So it was, you had to raise more money up front, and there was a higher failure rate of failing to gather. And just while we're talking gathering, as a footnote, you need to gather X number of signatures in 6 of the 8 congressional districts. It's 5% for a statutory measure and 8% of those voting in the last, for a constitutional, of those voting in the last governor's election. But anyway, the conventional wisdom used to seem to be, don't go for a constitutional amendment unless you really feel you have to. Again, there was a cost you might fail element to it. There was also a very strong conventional wisdom that the voters disliked constitutional amendments, and that there was a 3 to 5 point bias against them, where if you put the very same measure before the voters, a statutory amendment would get about 3 to 5% more votes than a constitutional measure. And I think that's now kind of out the window. I mean, that was something that people who are active in this world, you know, believed it was part of the thinking. But it seems to me that that's largely gone. And maybe the best example of that is our medical marijuana measures in 2018, where the constitutional measure, which added to the word count a lot, and the passed, and the statutory measure did not. So in concluding, I'm just going to say I'm not convinced we really have a problem in Missouri. I mean, the Jim is correct. The Missouri Constitution serves a different purpose than a federal constitution. Yes, of course, there's some silly stuff in the Missouri Constitution. I don't know that that is any public policy crisis. I do agree with Jim that some reasonable mechanism for error correction is desirable, where we're building these long measures that look like what Justice Marshall called a legal code, with none of the usual process in the legislature that the speaker is going to talk about here in a minute. You know, no ability to correct errors, not, you don't have hundreds of people commenting and doing the work to identify problems or inconsistencies. So I tend to worry more about the quality of the work and what's in the Constitution than the quantity. And I think some mechanism where those errors could be corrected within reason and without amending having to go back to a vote makes quite a bit of sense. So I'll stop there. Thank you, Judge, for the nice introduction, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having me today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lowell. And I see some questions are coming in, so folks, keep those questions coming in. As I say, we'll get to those in the Q&A session. And now it is my pleasure to introduce you to you the Speaker Pro Tem of the Missouri House of Representatives, John Wyman, who is a Republican. He represents parts of a part of St. Charles County. He was elected to his first 2-year term in 2014, has been reelected in 2016, 2018, and most recently, of course, in 2020. He was born in St. Louis, but raised down south on 44 in St. James, Missouri. He's a graduate of the University of Missouri Columbia with a bachelor's in business administration and a master's in health administration. He lives in O'Fallon with his wife and 2 sons. He's the president and CEO of Midwest Physician Insurance Advisors, which is a brokerage firm specializing in medical malpractice insurance. He's a member of a number of boards and chambers of commerce, and he's also a member of the Board of Trustees of the Missouri State Employees Retirement System. So with that, it is my pleasure to turn it over to Speaker Pro Tem John Wyman.
Thank you, Judge Clark. I hope you can hear me well. First off, I wanted to thank the Federalist Society for the invitation to be part of this panel and look forward to hopefully contributing something to it. I appreciate this opportunity. I have some written remarks that I'm going to read. I apologize. I didn't really know what the format was going to be, so I just wanted to make sure I had something in writing just to kind of express my thoughts on this whole process. But just to kind of get to it, really, I think the question is the future of the Missouri Constitution and the potential of a constitutional convention, along with an initiative petition reform measures currently in legislature, is the question that we're all looking at right now. As we know, the Missouri Constitution under Article 12, Section 3A specifically states that every 20 years, the Secretary of State shall, and the General Assembly by law, may submit to the electors of the state the question, shall there be a convention to revise and amend the Constitution? And I think to understand this, we are, you know, really what we need to look at is just kind of the history of this whole process in Missouri. Since the original construction of the original Constitution was created in 1820, our state has held conventions in 1865, 1875, and 1945, which resulted in our third and current version of the state constitution. For the past 59 years, the state has decided to not call for a convention, which I find very interesting. However, the movement for initiative petitions has steadily increased over the decades. Missouri is one of 11 states that allow direct citizen initiative petition for both statutory and constitutional amendments. In reviewing other states' constitutions, there are 8 states that don't allow constitutional initiative petitions. There are 16 states that permit direct constitutional initiatives, 3 states that only allow indirect constitutional initiatives, and 24 states that allow some form of popular referendum, leaving 23 states that do not allow any initiative petition or popular referendums. The question before us is, do we need to conduct a constitutional convention? Obviously, from Missouri history, it is not uncommon for our state to not modify the Constitution. We've done it in the past, and there's always that potential we could do it again in the future. Over the past 76 years, the Missouri Constitution has grown, as it's been stated before, to well over 80,000 words and contains amended language that most would agree does not belong in the Constitution, but rather in statute. Specifically, we've added the following items, and I like to rattle these off. Sometimes I bring this to attention to my friends in the legislature. But the list is, and this is not all encompassing, but I thought you guys would find this interesting. Bingo, which we've all mentioned, gambling, horse racing, riverboat gambling, lotteries, paramutual wagering, raffles and sweepstakes. There seems to be a trend there. Blind pension fund, conservation commission, conservation sales tax, stem cell research, clean Missouri, cleaner Missouri, which wasn't a constitutional change, but medical cannabis and Medicaid expansion, to name a few. It certainly appears the Missouri Constitution has evolved into another version of the revised statutes, which leads me back to the original question, do we need to revise our state constitution? I believe there's a growing concern from the citizens that our initiative process is being used by special interest groups who are unable to enact legislation to benefit through the normal legislative process. Case in point, recent attempts by outside political groups to significantly change our redistricting process, i.e. Clean Missouri, or amendment, I think it was Amendment 2, demonstrates the danger of low thresholds required to change our state constitution. The framers of our U.S. Constitution believe that states and our Congress should be able to amend the Constitution, but they also set the bar very high in order to protect against whimsical political ideas of the day. As a result, in over 245 years, we've only amended it 27 times. However, Missouri Constitution has been amended over 60 times in the past 76 years. The problem is simple. It has become too easy to change our Constitution given the modern age of mass media. All you need to do is to collect, and I know we have a little bit of disagreement with my friend Lowell Pearson on this, but All you need to do is collect around 120,000 signatures that are valid signatures. You generally have to collect more than that, but you only need to go to three counties in this state. And that'll get you six congressional districts, and spend, depending on the issue, anywhere between $2 to $4 million in marketing. And then, of course, I always call it the ballot candy language, like clean or medicinal, and the voters will likely approve with a simple majority vote. While the IP process is an important constitutional tool for Missourians, the reality is that most average citizens don't invest the time to read the proposed amendment and rely on basically slick marketing advertisements to educate themselves about the virtues of the initiative petition. Bottom line, then, amending the state constitution should be difficult, just like it is to amend the U.S. Constitution. Now, with regards to specific bills in the General Assembly, I did prepare a summary document, which I hope has been distributed to those who are on this call. I don't have it on my computer, but which basically explains the existing bills and resolutions that are currently before the legislature right now. And I'll just kind of briefly cover, there's 12 bills specifically or resolutions that have been filed. And I'll just kind of cover some of the common themes that are out there right now. One in particular is some related to the Secretary of State's office and administrative process, kind of changing the filing fees, increasing those, and also certain procedures regarding signature collection and reporting. And then also requiring maybe him to have a online database that could be easily accessible for citizens to look at who's putting forth these initiative petitions and who's out there collecting signatures. Another one deals with signature requirements for constitutional amendments be 8% of legal voters in all 8 congressional districts. Now that's a pretty serious increase in requirements, because as you know, right now you only need to get 6 out of the 8 congressional districts. And it doesn't have to be a total voters. It's this one here would be a little bit higher threshold, well, a lot higher threshold. Also, signature requirements should change from congressional to each county. That's another one. It's pretty substantial. We have 114 counties in this state, and that would be a significant barrier, I believe, to gathering signatures for an initiative petition. That also would include 5% of voters in each county for statutory amendments and 8%. Of voters in each county for constitutional amendments. Another requirement that's being proposed is that every petition include the name of the individual or group sponsoring the petition and to be subject to financial disclosure provisions under state law. Some of that's already in statute right now, but this is another attempt to try to identify those who are individuals or groups that are specifically trying to move a particular issue through an initiative petition process. Another one is the requirement to collect signatures for 12% of legal voters in every congressional district and then submit to the General Assembly for approval to the place on the ballot. Once again, that's raising the standard pretty high. I mean, the highest standard right now is 8% for constitutional. This would go to 12% of all legal voters. So that's a much higher threshold. Another proposal is to prohibit the modification. This is actually of personal interest because this is my bill, House Bill 850, is to prohibit the modification of summary statements or ballot language approved by the General Assembly or constitutional amendments or statutory measures. Courts would not have jurisdiction to rewrite or edit such language prior to placing it on the ballot. The idea behind that particular proposal is that the legislature, we have Senate joint resolutions, House joint resolutions. We put issues to the vote of the people. We sometimes put in ballot language. In most cases, we do. We put our specific ballot language that we want to have to be, before the voters. And what's happening is that it's being, that process is being usurped by the courts, because our opponents of that particular resolution will file a lawsuit, take it to court, and then now we have circuit courts, appeals courts, Supreme Courts rewriting ballot language that went through a pretty extensive legislative process. And so that's really the premise behind that. Another thing is to require ballot language to be written in plain language, easily understood by an individual with the 6th grade reading level. I don't quite think that bill is going to make it all the way, but this, and it's already currently in statute, it has to be in plain language anyway. So that one is not really moving at this point in time, but that's just another example of what legislators have proposed. Another one is constitutional amendments require a petition to be signed by 15% of legal voters. So once again, it's the same, raising the threshold. I will tell you that I've seen some recent polling data in Missouri regarding the initiative integrity, which suggests that a majority of Missourians support changes to our IP process, along with greater transparency. In particular, one of the questions was posed, oftentimes voters don't know anything about a proposed law or constitutional change until they read it on their ballot when they arrive at the polls. Would you support or oppose requiring ballot initiative sponsors to hold a public hearing where citizens can ask questions about the proposed change before voting on it? The vote count was 82% supported that idea, 99% opposed it, and 12% were unsure. Another question, would you support or oppose requiring petitions for proposed laws and constitutional changes to gather at least 100 valid signatures from each county in the state? This is an interesting number. 53% supported that, 29% opposed, and 18% were unsure. So, you know, I think in summary, there's no question that I think that we need to strongly consider the ability of especially outside groups, special interest groups, to be able to come into our state and really kind of usurp and go around the traditional republic that we have is to take it through the legislature and have it fully vetted. And so I think that's worthy of discussion, whether we do that through the IP process, through a resolution process, or do we do a constitutional convention. I think that's still for debate. But anyway, with that, I'll be happy to conclude my remarks and take any questions.
All right. Thank you, Speaker Wyman. And we'll get to the audience's questions in a few minutes after we have a little bit of debate amongst our three panelists here. And I see some more questions are coming in. So one topic that I'd like you all to address a little bit more is this notion of whether a supermajority ought to be required to amend the Constitution or whether it ought to stay the simple majority. Jim's proposal and Jim and his colleagues' proposal is that it remain a simple majority and that it be vetted by the voters twice. So question, Jim, I'd like you to address is with respect to why does having something passed by 50% plus one vote twice make it any more representative of the people than if it just passes once by 50 plus 1%? And I'm going to give a little bit more framing to that, if you'll allow me. As you mentioned, the United States Constitution requires 2/3 of both legislatures and then 3/4 of the state legislatures. When we talk about 3/4 of the state legislatures, we're really amping up, if you will, the supermajority proposal or supermajority concept, because most legislatures in our state, in our country, rather, most state legislatures are bicameral. They have a House and a Senate. So you need the passage in both the House and the Senate of each state. I think it's Nebraska is a unicameral legislature. There may be another one, I don't recall. But the notion of having 2/3 of the House and the Senate and then 3/4 of the state legislatures really has a very, very broad base of people voting for it and people's elected representatives. So with that, Jim, again, my question just to frame it is why is twice passing by 50 plus one better than just once?
Well, it seems to me there are two different things that we try and accomplish by changing this, by distinguishing between what we can do in legislation versus what we do with a constitutional amendment. One of those is to simply say it takes more. Not it takes more to get it on the ballot. That's where the legislature seems to be focused. And Mike and David and I think that's the wrong way to go. But to say to the people, okay, it takes more for you to actually change your constitution than to just change a statute. And that purpose can be served either by the approach that we suggested, which is voting twice. You have to, it may take the same number, but they're going to have to do it twice, or by having some kind of supermajority. And there are certainly states that have 60% or 55% or something like that. And I think Mike, Dave, and I would be supportive of making some kind of a change. The reason we put out this different approach, which is used in some states, is because the other purpose of making this distinction is to ensure that we only put the things in our Constitution that people have thought about for a while. So it's not enough that there is a concern in 2021 and 2022 for something, or that it serves a particular constituency or a particular philosophical group in a political party or something. It serves them to get this on the ballot. Instead, we have to come back and look again. And so instead of just saying, okay, everybody's hot on this year, and so we ought to change our Constitution, we would say, if you're not still hot on it 2 years later, then why are we putting it in the Constitution? A statute, maybe, but why are we putting it in the Constitution if 2 years later we don't still think this is worth doing?
Thank you, Jim. So, Speaker Wyman, I'd ask you to address that and your thoughts on why having a greater threshold for passing, as well as a greater threshold for getting something on the ballot, would be beneficial.
Well, I think we've seen just in recent history that we've had some issues that, you know, for example, Medicaid expansion. I mean, that was an issue that, it was pretty contentious in the legislature for many, many years. And there was many attempts by very powerful forces to try to get us to take up and pass Medicaid expansion through the legislature. And it just didn't have the support of the elected officials in this state. And so what happened then is it just basically was those interest groups decided to go around us. And I kind of like the idea of the possibility, if we don't raise the threshold, then at least we put it to the vote twice, because it kind of gives the option for more time to educate the population and the citizens about what legislation we're looking to add to the Constitution or to our statutes. So I'm more in favor of just raising the threshold for just the constitutional changes that we would make to make it even more difficult to change our Constitution. I think most of the issues that we've dealt with in the past really should have been statutes versus constitutional changes. But I think most of my members here in the legislature, at least on my side of the aisle, are very much in support of raising the standard, at least on constitutional changes to our Constitution.
Thank you, Speaker Wyman. Lowell, I'm going to turn to you and have you address the issue, and feel free to respond to either of those comments first, and then I've got another issue for you to address.
Okay, yeah, I'll respond briefly. Well, there's one group of people who are doing handstands at Jim's idea of the double voting, which are the political consultants and the media buyers who are now doubling their income. The lawyers don't get any more money by doing it twice, Jim, you know, so you don't have the right market idea here, but it might be a good one from a public policy perspective. I do want to warn the group, however, that if we went to, say, a 55 or 60% requirement, we would not have the bingo amendment from 2018. It only had 52%. So, you know, you're playing with fire here. I tend to agree with Jim's, I don't know that I agree with the double vote, but I do agree with the premise behind it, which is it shouldn't be harder to get on the ballot. That isn't the problem, because we don't really have that many things making it on the ballot. And it does cost a lot of money, and there are things that can go wrong in terms of signature gathering. So I probably, on the theory of keeping it simple, would be more with my friend the speaker of perhaps raising the threshold rather than the double vote. I think that makes some sense. And so I'll stop there. I think you had another topic, Judge.
Well, I do. It's related. You mentioned the money and the political consultants and the media buyers who enrich themselves on these amendments. And if you had two votes, there would be, you know, just more of that going around. But we're talking about two different thresholds, right? We're talking about the threshold by which a measure passes, but before that, it has to get on the ballot. And so the number or percentage of signatures that need to be gathered and valid signatures that need to be gathered. So as I understand it, typically the petition, the signature gatherers are folks who are paid per signature. At least that's what I'd seen a number of times. And so if we, and then oftentimes the signatures are challenged and the signatures are reviewed, and if the signatures are not valid, those are stricken out. They're not considered at all. And then, so you have to get, as you mentioned earlier, more signatures than the actual threshold number. So if we raise that threshold number of signatures that you have to get, are we essentially making it even more of a special interest process, right? So that now that we're raising the number of signatures, we're also raising the amount of money that one needs to just get something on the ballot, much less the media campaign to promote it once it's on the ballot. So would you address that issue of how the raising of the number of signatures to get something on the ballot may or may not play into the hands of what people say are special interests or moneyed interests, who, and it's no longer really the people's ability, you know, the average person's ability to get something on the ballot.
Yeah, sure. And John's right. I think he had the statistics about right. If you collect wisely, and you have a strategy that you're going for 6 of the 8 congressional districts and ignoring the other 2, which is what signature gathering people do, you need about 120,000 signatures. If it is generally thought that if you have a really well-organized, well-done signature gathering operation, you could get about a 65% validity rate. Nobody cuts it that close. Generally, people want to have twice the amount needed. And this is all very sophisticated, by the way. I mean, the signature gathering people are doing nightly tracking and verification. So they know with a very high level of accuracy how many signatures they have in each congressional district, almost on a nightly basis as they're doing this. Judge, there's no question that this is, this is expensive. But increasingly, people are feeling it's a route that gives that that's worth the money for a couple reasons. First, it can take years to get something through the legislature, and that might be wise. But increasingly, people are saying to themselves, "Well, if I have a sophisticated lobbying effort over several years in the General Assembly, that's not cheap either. There's a lot of education that goes into that, and building sort of a grassroots campaign that might be that would educate the legislature about the need for it. The speaker's also right. Whether you like this or not, if I were sitting in the General Assembly, I probably wouldn't, John. So I get where you're coming from. But this has largely become now a way to get something that you couldn't get in the legislature. I mean, most of the things that have passed that are high profile, Clean Missouri, the campaign finance amendments in 2016, Medicaid expansion, most of those have been things that have been before the General Assembly, and the proponents have failed. So to convince the General Assembly to enact them or put them on the, either as a statute or to put them on the ballot. So there's no question that, this is something of an end run, and it already is an option that is not really low cost and grassroots. So changing the number makes it, I guess, a little more of that, but I'm not sure it really fundamentally changes what the system already is right now.
So following up on that notion, you've outlined a number of different proposals. Was any of these what one would call a grassroots proposal going back to 2012?
Let me just take a look at my notes. Maybe a couple could be described that way. Although, with some help from moneyed interests. But, the big public policy things, you have to spend the money to get on the ballot, and then you have to run the media campaign to convince the voters. And what's interesting is there have been huge disparities in that second part of the spending. Millions of dollars on one side and almost nothing on the other. Now, sometimes those have not come out the way the money would dictate. But any competent Well, let me back up. There is a whole art to doing this. And grassroots signature gathering with volunteers is something that many of these people have used. And there, and one of the reasons you do that is you build support for it because people feel invested in it, because they're out helping do the work to gather the signatures. So I think your question, Judge, in a way sort of asks a binary question that maybe doesn't really exist. It's not just a grassroots effort over here, and it's not just a money thing over here. An effective campaign has elements of both.
Thank you. And so I'm going to turn to Jim then on the issue of this notion of two votes and how, you know, in a sense, kind of a similar concept, and that's the tenor of some of the questions we're getting from the audience as well, is, you know, is this really helping the people of the state of Missouri, or is it really helping those people who make money off this process, and is it helping only those who have enough money to sustain and maintain two campaigns to get something on the ballot twice and to, you know, run the campaign to get people to vote for it?
Well, I think it depends on whether you look at it short term or long term. Largely, it would end many of these efforts. They would either be too expensive or too frustrating. It just wouldn't happen. And if you like me think the Missouri Constitution has gotten to be too complex, too much like a statute, then slowing down that process is a value. And whether these are things put on the ballot by the initiative petition or the legislature, it doesn't matter. Both places can come up with things that really don't deserve to be in our Constitution. And long term, we can slow that down. And that's part of why we urge that. But, you know, much of this discussion is about the initiative petition, but I don't want the legislature off the hook. I mean, the legislature puts things on the ballot because in a particular year, people in the legislature think, oh, if I put this on the ballot, then I can claim I got it on the ballot. I changed the Constitution. And many of those things are either pointless or they have collateral consequences that we haven't seen yet. And yet they get on the ballot. They are often passed. And the speaker has a proposal that would let the legislature say unilaterally with no check on the ballot what things are, so they could describe it however they want. You know, in my view, the legislature too ought to be restricted in the way it can change the Missouri Constitution. And that's why one reason we focused on the threshold and not just on this process of getting things on the ballot. The Constitution should not be used as just a place where people can get things on for their own kind of political purposes short term. It should be a place that we deal with the fundamental questions about how the state of Missouri should operate.
I'm going to turn it to the speaker in just a moment, but one other just concept that I'll mention for everyone to consider, our panelists as well as our audience, is that when you go through the legislative process, you're not finished, right? If you get a bill passed by the House and the Senate, then it goes to the governor, right? And in our state, the governor can either veto it or not sign it at all, and it becomes law without a veto. So there's, you know, another hurdle to clear. There's another branch of government. There's the, you know, another people's elected representative in the process. So just I put that out there conceptually for people to consider.
Well, but keep in mind, the legislature can put things on the ballot. That was concealed carry, that are not constitutional amendments. If the legislature wants to do that and wants to avoid having something have to get the governor's signature. So they can do that. They occasionally do that.
Well, I think Jim is invoking the goose gander rule. So what's good for the goose is good for the gander in some senses, right? But that, I think the speaker would like an opportunity to be heard on this issue. Mr. Speaker, please.
Well, I appreciate that opportunity. You know, with regards to Jim's comments about politicians wanting to do things during election years, I just find it completely uncalled for and unreasonable. But in reality, I tell people, you know what? It's politics. It's, you know, we're elected by our respective citizens in our districts. We come up here to represent our, you know, I always tell people we're state reps, so we're not district reps, but we're here to represent the interests of the citizens of Missouri, but politics is in everything. Politics is even in our court systems, whether we want to admit it or not. Politics is everywhere. And so I think, you know, as politicians, do we sometimes take advantage of that opportunity to put something on the ballot that probably shouldn't be on the ballot because either we know it's not going to pass, or one, we want to grandstand or try to get attention. Certainly that happens. And that's, I would hope that's not something that's on a regular basis. But I think more importantly, you know, the reason, and I agree with the idea that, you know, raising the standard for collecting signatures and things along that lines, I don't know if that necessarily is going to be the solution to our perceived problems, but certainly changing our constitution should not be an easy process. And right now, with just getting a simple majority vote one time, to me, it's just too easy. And that standard needs to be raised. As far as the other aspects of it, the number of signatures and where they come from, you know, that's, in my opinion, it's open for debate. But, you know, the whole process of passing laws in our country and in our state, you know, the legislature has that right. That is what that's our purpose, is to, you know, pass laws. It's not the purpose of the judiciary. It's not the purpose of the executive branch. And so when you have direct initiative petitions, you're basically having, you're not really having a republic, you're having direct democracy, and you're having, you know, almost to a certain extent mob rule, where they're going out and coming up with legislative ideas, putting it on the ballot that haven't been vetted. I mean, that's why it takes so long to get bills passed in this legislature, because, you know, when we have hearings, we debate it on the floor, it has to go through many, many, many gyrations of review before it gets, you know, signed. And even then, it may not get signed by the governor. And then we have challenges by the courts, or by, you know, people who challenge the laws, they'll take it to the courts, and then you guys get to decide whether it's constitutional or not. So, you know, I think it is well within our right as a legislature to, you know, develop laws, propose laws, and even to the extent to propose a law and have the citizens vote on it. So I think that's well within our legal right and our constitutional right to do that. And I think, you know, for us in the future, you know, we're going to be trying to do what we can to protect that right.
Thank you. So a couple of more topics quickly before we turn to questions from the audience, and I see a number of them continue to come in. So the correction mechanism, and this is a theme of some of the questions that we've received, this correction mechanism. So I think Lowell and Jim essentially agree on that there's a necessity of a correction mechanism for some of these provisions, especially some of these more detailed provisions. Some of the questions centered on whether is there a specific problem with the medical marijuana provision that needs to be corrected and the like. So with respect to the correction mechanism, I want the speaker to address that first, if he would, because recognizing that the legislature can propose certain amendments, do you see the need for a correction mechanism once something is actually in the Constitution?
Well, you know, depending on how it's put into the Constitution, I think if it's done through a process where there's been lots of contemplation, there's been lots of review, it's an issue that was well thought out and was put in the Constitution, I'm more reluctant to not go back and try to change it. In our case with the Missouri Constitution, we have a lot of stuff that's been added to it. I like the idea that Jim laid out, as far as, you know, I'm all about doing things easier and, you know, and not working harder, but working smarter. And if perhaps we could create a commission to review our existing constitution and try to find ways to streamline it and get it back to where it should be as a true constitutional document versus something more like a statute, revised statutes. But, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, amendments to the Constitution should be a big thing, should be a big deal. And we should be very reluctant to change those. We should be very reluctant to put things on the Constitution. So if it's already on there, I think it's, you know, it's within our purview to every 20 years, if we want to address it and have a convention if we need to, or have a commission. and take up those issues and hopefully think them through and decide whether it's something we should continue to keep in the Constitution or take out. But I think back to my original point is that ultimately, I think that's why I'm making the issue that we should be set that bar very high with regards to changing our Constitution or amending our Constitution.
Thank you. So Jim and Lowell, if you'd each just give just a little bit about the correction process and how that would, how in your view we could have a correction process that would not disenfranchise the voters who voted for a particular amendment.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
Any correction process that I propose, I think would still be on the ballot as a new change. So I don't think the voters would be cut out of that process. But I see this process as in part being a requirement, because if you increase the threshold for making changes to the Constitution, then you need some method of a more expedited method of addressing issues that are created in those amendments or that exist in current provisions. And that's part of why we proposed it. But part of it is to try and make a document that is a little bit more coherent, maybe shorter, a little more coherent. And so let me give two areas that might be of value, and an example of where it was done in the past. The example in the past is in 1976, when our entire judicial article was rewritten. So all the court system was redone in Missouri in 1976. Not the first time that's happened in Missouri. Back in the 1800s, there was a day where the Constitution was amended to abolish all circuit judgeships and then create new ones. So the new governor got to appoint all of the judges in Missouri. What a deal. But it was a coherent effort to have a single article redone all at once to address the judiciary. And two areas that we might think about doing something like that are, first off, one of those that was mentioned by the speaker when you list the kinds of things in our current Constitution, when you mentioned bingo and horse racing and raffles, that's all there because we have a prohibition in our Constitution on the legislature allowing for lotteries. And then we keep creating these little exceptions, like a casino within 1,000 feet of the main channel on the Missouri or Mississippi rivers, or a raffle by a charitable institution. And it may be that we could come back and pull all those together and develop something that's more coherent. The longest sections deal with state debt. And we have various provisions that deal with where the state can have debt. And it may be that those ought to be revised in a way that is more coherent than these things that just happen one at a time. And so my hope would be that if we created a commission, that it would be proactive, that would actually look at provisions at full sections of the Constitution and say, okay, what are we really trying to accomplish here? Can we do that in a way that just makes more sense, not just gets rid of unconstitutional provisions like women not being on juries, but actually makes more sense and will help us in the future to be able to address the needs of Missourians?
Thank you, Jim. Lowell, just briefly on the correction mechanism.
Yeah, in general, I think Jim's got a good idea that that's something we need to look at. I will say one person's error is another person's careful drafting. So the slope is pretty slippery on that. So while in general, I do like the concept, and I will say there's a definitional issue here too, because I don't see a lot of just outright errors, you know, where the wrong word is used. But I do think some of the measures both internally lack any coherence and then don't fit very well with things that exist. Jim makes a good point.
Uh-oh, we've lost Lowell's audio. So Jim, I guess that's fortunate. Lowell, or maybe unfortunate, Lowell was just saying you make a good point. And then we lost him. So with that, Lowell, I'm not sure if you can hear us, but we'll move on to some audience questions, and then we can bring this back to you if we get you back. So A number of the questions, I alluded to this earlier, a number of folks have asked for pointing to examples of the need for correction. Some have asked, because the medical marijuana one has come up a number of times today, are there specific problems with the medical marijuana amendment, or are there others that have specific issues that do need to be amended, or that there's a, I guess, let's call it a robust consensus that there's a need for amendment or correction, as opposed to, as what Lowell was saying, that one person's error is another person's careful drafting. So, Jim, I see you smiling and looking as if you're ready to address that.
That's in part because I saw that who it was who was posing the questions about medical marijuana, and I'm sure that he had a role in drafting that. I don't know that I see something there that is a problem today, but I see things that may be a problem tomorrow. And so let me give you an example there of something that could be a problem. There's a provision in the medical marijuana amendment that provides for the applications that are submitted to the Department of Health and Senior Services to be confidential. They have to be maintained as confidential. We're currently in court, currently in the Court of Appeals, addressing whether that means that the applications submitted by those who want to have dispensary or cultivation or manufacturing licenses are confidential from their competitors who are litigating the denial of their own licenses. In the course of doing that, of deciding that, the courts are going to decide what confidentiality means. Well, let's suppose that the proponents even of the medical marijuana amendment don't like how the courts have interpreted this concept of confidentiality and whether their names and information can be kept confidential from other litigants. Their solution then would only be to have a new constitutional amendment, because they couldn't go to the General Assembly and say, fix this, because the General Assembly would have to say, we can't fix this because you put it in the Constitution. And that's the kind of thing that concerns me, not that I can name things today, but we have kind of taken these details, and it may not make sense that a stem cell violation should be subject to a particular criminal penalty anymore, but to change it, we have to go to the voters in a constitutional amendment. And that simply doesn't make any sense to me.
And Jim, are you familiar with any situations where there has been an amendment of an amendment that was proposed by the initiative passed by the initiative?
No. I mean, the legislature did that recently with this Cleaner Missouri, which also gets back to this whole title question, because the title the legislature passed there, the court said, was just outrageous. But it happens that one thing gets passed over another. But you know, the cost, even under current thresholds, the cost of getting something on the ballot to once is so high that that they don't come back and do it again.
All right. So we've got a couple of more minutes before I turn it back to Mark Bremer. But so, Speaker Wyman, it seems that you might have something to say there in response to what Jim has said about this amendment, as well as the ballot title issue specific to Cleaner Missouri and perhaps others. So please.
You know, what do they say? What's good for the goose is good for the gander. I mean, same scenario here. I actually joke around here in the legislature. I said, all we have to do is pass a bill. We put the word clean or medicinal or benevolent in front of it, and everybody will be supportive of it. So, you know, it's okay for them to do that, those on the opposite side of whatever issue it is, for them to use the ballot candy language and whatnot. But then when we do it, then all of a sudden it's outrageous that we did the same thing that they did. But, you know, I get it. I understand, you know, it's all, once again, it goes back to my whole point, is that when you put something on the ballot, you have people who are voting for it who, and I hate to say that they're not qualified to be voting on this, but they have not spent the time and invested the energy in researching and understanding, especially a constitutional amendment, a very complex, you know, proposal to change our constitution or add to our constitution. We're letting citizens make those decisions, and they're making it based on very flimsy, minimal information. And I just think that's a concern that we need to address.
You mentioned earlier in your opening remarks the notion that the average voter doesn't read the actual language of the amendment. They rely on the ballot title and they rely on the marketing campaigns around those. What are the fixes for that in your view? How do we change that? I mean, and really, in a sense, it's a question that gets to, can we really, it's a sociological experiment, can we really change voter behavior in that regard, or at least within the depth that's necessary to get to what you're getting at? But I'll leave that to the social scientists, but would love your comments on that.
Well, you know, I certainly think taking longer, I like the idea, like Jim suggested, maybe we have a vote, maybe we have a second vote that gives more time for it to sink in, more education to occur. It always seems like we're always rushing the last minute to get the word out to, hey, support this amendment or support that petition, be against it, be for it. And you have your talking points. I don't know if there's an immediate fix to a long-term social problem where people have a lack of interest in our government in the first place. That's been going on for a long time. And I don't know how you fix that, but you know, it's just, I think we need to be very careful about putting people in those positions where they're making decisions that have effects in our Constitution, where they really haven't had the opportunity, or they haven't taken the opportunity to really educate themselves before they vote on an issue. I can tell you that, quite honestly, there's people in the legislature, and I'm not naming names, but there's people in the legislature probably haven't even read some of the bills they voted for. And we're supposed to be the professionals. So I'm just saying that this is something that we need to be cognizant of and be aware of, that, you know, when we're putting this ballot issue before the people, we can put it as plain language as we can. But as we all know, sometimes it's a very complex issue. We don't understand what the ramifications are long term. I mean, medical marijuana, for example, and I'll end on this. That was, once again, another issue that was proposed in this building many, many times. I did surveys in my district. Anytime I said it was for medicinal purposes, I got like 60 or 70% of my constituents said, yes, I want it. But the minute I said recreational, they said, no, they don't want it. It was like 30% wanted it. And so I saw this one coming a long way away. With those that were in favor of medical marijuana, they went around us because they knew they couldn't get it through the legislature. I heard testimony after testimony from sheriffs and policemen and so forth from Colorado and other states, California, where they've adopted recreational marijuana. And it was not a pretty sight. But that information was never just distributed, or just, you know, where people could hear that mainstream around the state. So that's the problem. You know, it's just easy to package it up, put it away in a way that people think, oh, that sounds like a great idea. And then they vote for it impulsively and vote for something that then now is permanently in the Constitution, which we can't fix later on without a lot of effort. So I'll end with that.
Thank you.
In order to keep us on schedule, I want to thank our panelists. I thought this was highly informative, well-researched, and authoritative discussion by you, Jim, Lal, and John. And thank you very much, Judge Clark, for your well-informed guidance of the discussion. Thank you all.